What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. In this podcast, episode 278, we're going to be talking about a brand new calculator for estimating heart disease risk. Now, heart disease is the leading cause of death worldwide. In the United States, the prevalence of heart disease is increasing and is currently estimated to affect over 120 million adults over the age of 20. The most common type of heart disease is due to atherosclerosis, a gradual, lifelong process where cholesterol-rich plaques accumulate in the blood vessels and can lead to complications in various organs like the heart, brain, and other vital organs. Now, risk factors for atherosclerosis include high blood pressure, elevated LDL cholesterol, smoking, and metabolic abnormalities like diabetes that cumulatively increase risk over time. These and other risk factors effects are well characterized and have been incorporated into a number of widely used calculators that are used to estimate an individual's risk for having a heart attack, stroke, or developing heart disease over a given period of time. Until recently, most calculators were used to estimate a 10-year risk in adults over the age of 40 based on data collected over a decade ago. That is, until now. Recently, the American Heart Association has released a heart disease risk calculator called PREVENT, which stands for Predicting Risk of Cardiovascular Disease Events. And not only does it claim to be able to estimate risk up to 30 years in advance using the most recent data, it also includes adults as young as 30. In this podcast, we're going to review heart disease, discuss this new tool, and see if it lives up to the hype. On the other end of the line, I have the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's up, man? Welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks. Good to be back. Currently juggling a few things, working in the hospital, dealing with many patients experiencing heart and cerebrovascular disease. So this is relevant for my day to day.
Timely. Did you just get sick of people asking you when are you coming back to the podcast? Like you were just missed, and then people were just
they may have been asking me. I don't know that I was fully aware of these inquiries as I've been busy doing other things, but you know, here I am.
Here you are. You know, it's funny. I think I pinged you about this new PREVENT tool back in, it must have been November, because this is when it came out. Yeah. But it's like the scientific consensus statement from the American Heart Association and like a bunch of press releases regarding this tool all came out in advance of the tool actually going live.
Right.
And we were like scouring the internet trying to find like, where's this tool? And I guess somebody bought the domain. It was like PreventTool.com or PreventCalculator.com, and it just goes to some other like non-validated tool. And I'm like, what is going on here? Like, even the American Heart Association has competitors for the in the SEO space, like the search apparently. Engine
optimization. Yeah, I remember that happening, and we were just kind of annoyed. We were like, why did you guys announce this and then not give us the tool? Just tell us when it's ready.
Yeah, it's like, right. You know, it'd be one thing if they released all this information and they were like, look, on January 15th, we're going to launch this tool at this website. Whatever, sign up to get an email, like whatever. If you want to email capture, do your SEO, that's fine. But I was like, why can't I find this tool?
Well, here we are.
Like, here we are. Yeah, that's right. So I did wonder, you know, I was coming up with this outline. Is this our version of biohacking? or like optimization? You know, is this like our slant towards that? You know, we poo-poo on biohacking and like tracking all these weird metrics, or like trying to quote optimize various things that don't seem to make any sort of clinical difference. But because the risk factors for heart disease and sort of optimizing your risk, lifetime risk of heart disease seems to pay off. Is this like our version of biohacking?
I mean, I suppose it is. And if you looked at what people who use that admittedly cringe term for themselves are targeting, like actual quote unquote biohackers out there, if there was really robust evidence supporting the things that they're talking about, like, hey, if you do this to modify this biomarker, then you markedly reduce your risk of premature death or of developing this cancer, or you live better, or you live longer, you know, compared with placebo or not doing this thing or sham or something like that, then totally we'd be on board with that too. It's like that common quote that you hear where it's like people say that complementary and alternative medicine that works is just called medicine. it's like, you know, biohacking that works is just called medicine, I think.
Medicine. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you have to like hype it up to bill it as something special that's not yet like included, either it's so new that like it hasn't had a chance to travel around the world, which is rare but possible, or the far more likely situation is that it's actually BS and doesn't currently have enough evidence to actually be incorporated into routine care. So in that case, fine to have it as like a pet theory, you know, like mine was that ACE inhibitors could potentially increase muscular hypertrophy in aging adults being treated for high blood pressure, which didn't pan out. But, you know, holding that position confidently and making recommendations, particularly if they go against what we know to work, that's probably where we would draw the line.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't take that hypothesis back then and put out a new episode of the podcast saying that everybody should be taking ACE inhibitors because of this theoretical mechanism. Rather, you said that if you want to increase your muscle mass, you should train because, you know, we're quite confident that that works to increase muscle mass. And here's a theoretical mechanism, which doesn't even deserve almost airtime effectively because it needed to pan out and then it didn't. And then, you know, we've tucked it away and that's fine.
We just forget about it. Yeah, that's right. All right. So let's get into this podcast again. We're talking about the new Prevent cardiovascular risk tool. Before we get into all the risk factors and kind of what the new tool includes, we need to cover like what is heart disease and specifically what we're talking about. Now, Austin, I'm guessing that whenever you walk into a patient's room in the hospital and maybe it's a new diagnosis of some subtype or version of heart disease, you don't start the conversation with, you have heart disease and let me tell you about it. Like how do you conceptually frame this, you know, because you want to make sure it's understandable, but also not so generalized that it doesn't actually mean anything. So I'm very curious, how do you like go about doing this?
Yeah, obviously the nature of the conversation depends on the presentation that the patient's coming in with. But as always, I rarely am the person who starts talking when I go in the room. Rather, I'm like talking to the person. I say, hey, what do you know about what's going on? Tell me what you understand. And that gives me a great jumping off point based on whether they have a great understanding or have no idea whatsoever. And so if somebody's having, you know, what I would be concerned with is chest pain, for example, due to ischemia or not enough blood flow to their heart due to heart disease, then I might use that term. And then I might similarly ask them, what do you know about this? Have you heard anything about this? Similarly, to get a new jumping off point for their level of understanding. Same thing as it relates to stroke, or if it's impacting their kidney function, or they're, you know, having not enough blood flow to their limbs or something like that. And then I can try to fold in some, you know, generally understandable analogies of blood flow, like pipes and things like that, which is admittedly a pretty dramatic oversimplification. And in some situations is actually the wrong analogy to kind of use, but I use it where applicable and see if I can get people to understand. Of course, by the time I'm in that type of a scenario where I work in an inpatient hospital setting, most of the time it's more of a secondary prevention scenario, meaning that the person, or even tertiary, the person has already established heart disease, or they've even already had a complication of heart disease. And I'm just trying to, you know, risk manage or prevent further damage, do damage control on these patients. In contrast, patients who are more in the outpatient realm, primary care, or like, you know, generally healthy, fitness oriented people listening to this podcast, that's more of a primary prevention type scenario where it's like they might not have established heart disease yet, and we're doing things that we can to try to reduce the risk of it developing and progressing over the course of the lifespan to the point where somebody has a complication from it.
Yeah, that's the thing too. Like our listenership now, I know, like I've done some surveys to figure out like who our audience is. And, you know, in general, we're in that 25 to 50 year old range. That's our primary listenership. Now, obviously, there are other people who listen to our podcast. But the point is, like, if you're towards the younger end of that, like, I don't know that heart disease is like front and center in your brain, but definitely towards the, you know, latter half of that age demographic. If it's not, front and center to your brain as far as like things you would wish to avoid from a health perspective, that it should be getting there. And so when we talk about heart disease, you know, this refers to a number of different types of conditions that can affect the heart. The most common is atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, which we abbreviate ASCVD. And this affects the majority of adults past the age of 60. Like new onset cardiovascular disease occurs in about half of men before the age of 65, a quarter before age 55, and one third of women before age 65. And this includes four major like subtypes. One is coronary heart disease that affects the actual arteries supplying the heart. This can result in things like a heart attack, which is called a myocardial infarction, angina, chest pain, and or heart failure. There's also cerebrovascular disease, and that is, you know, disease within the vasculature supplying the brain. This can result in things like stroke or a transient ischemic attack. There's also peripheral artery disease, which can result in intermittent claudication or limb ischemia, not enough blood flow to the limbs. And so you get muscle pain, potentially muscle death and dysfunction. And lastly, abnormalities of the aorta. So you can get atherosclerosis in the aorta. You can get aneurysms at any point in the aorta. These are just four like broad categories of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. Now, coronary heart disease, that's the one affecting the, quote, to use your language, the pipes supplying the heart, if you will, the coronary arteries themselves. That's the most common type of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, ASCVD, and this represents about half of all of that particular subtype. The lifetime risk of coronary heart disease varies, importantly, with the cumulative risk factor burden. So we're going to talk about risk factors, but this is a very important part, like point to take home, to internalize, to really get that it's not just the presence of the risk factor at any one point in time, but it's how deviated that risk factor is, like how elevated it is, how serious it is, and how long you've had it for, like how many years. And the analogy that I think we've both kind of used when describing this is like smoking, right? Like one cigarette is unlikely to have cause a big issue. But if you regularly smoke cigarettes, you know, particularly over 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, that cumulative lifetime exposure is the you know, a much larger risk than something in the short term. And so we're really talking about this, again, cumulative risk factor burden. So let's talk about some risk factors of heart disease. And I'm, you know, we've done a number of podcasts where we talk about these in great detail, so we won't spend too much time, but just so you guys, the listeners, know what we're talking about. Established risk factors for heart disease, you know, you're talking about lipids, specifically the atherogenic lipoprotein fractions. That's a fancy way of saying things like LDL, triglycerides, other ones that we've referred to in the past, elevated blood pressure, excess body fat, insufficient activity levels, smoking, of course, increased age and the male sex both appear to be risk factors. Of course, a family history of heart disease, particularly premature heart disease, so occurring in the younger years before, you know, 40s, 50s, insufficient or poor kidney function. Poor diet, poor metabolic health, which can be reflected by abnormalities in blood sugar. So these would be individuals with diabetes, prediabetes, or things like that. Certain chronic inflammatory diseases. And I think the big thing here is that, you know, even at subclinical sort of perturbations or alterations in these levels can still cause increased risk. So we're talking about elevated blood pressure that's not really hypertension, or abnormal blood sugar that's not full-blown, you know, diabetes yet, for example, or weird-looking cholesterol levels that's not quite at the level that, you know, you say, oh, you for sure need to take a statin, for example. It's just these elevations, even at subclinical levels, can induce this sort of an increase in risk over time. And it also should be said that some people who have a what's known as like a major adverse cardiac event, so like a heart attack, like a stroke or whatever, some of these people have either no reestablished risk factors or like relatively low amounts of established risk factors. That doesn't mean these risk factors don't in fact increase risk. Just sometimes, you know, it do be like that. And there's other stuff that contribute to actually having one of these adverse events.
Yeah, there's a lot of different paths to the bad outcome, basically. And I think that, you know, to reiterate a couple important points that you've made is that even if, you know, all of these variables that you mentioned, be it cholesterol, blood pressure, body fat, activity, et cetera, all those things, they operate on a spectrum. It's not a high or low, even though the lab test will either flag it as high or low. It's much more complicated than that in the spectrum. And so say somebody just has, you know, everything else is great, but they have raging sky high blood cholesterol levels because they have an abnormal genetic condition that they were born with impacting that. Well, those people get a lot of exposure to this very quickly, very early in life, and they can start having heart attacks in their 30s and 40s. That's something that's known. Or you can have not everything great and one raging abnormality, but you can have relatively mild abnormalities in 3, 4, 5 of these risk factors. Maybe you have a little bit of excess body fat, maybe mildly elevated blood cholesterol, maybe mildly elevated blood pressure. Maybe you smoke one cigarette a day because that's your guilty pleasure or something like that. And cumulatively, collectively, these things might also drive your risk. And at a certain point of cumulative exposure, when you combine these risk factors with somebody's genetic predisposition, you might get to a point where you experience one of these bad events. And again, none of it is ever guaranteed. It's always just a game of probabilities. In the same way that you might know somebody who smoked for 70 years, your great grandmother smoked her entire life and then didn't die of lung cancer, because it's just probabilities. There's no certainty in this game. It's risk, right? Which is all probabilistic. And then the last thing I'll comment on, you know, you mentioned at the outset, our listenership, our demographic, people who might not start thinking about, you know, the risk of heart disease or what their own quote unquote heart health until they're more middle-aged, maybe a little bit even older than that. But to reiterate the statistic that we cited, that new onset cardiovascular disease occurs in half of men before the age of 65. A lot of people think about heart disease as something that doesn't hit until your 60s, 70s, 80s. But again, half of it begins before 65, a quarter of it before 55. And when we talk about it as being this gradually progressive thing that accumulates over time, that means that for a quarter of people before 55, or for the half of men before 65, or the third of women before 65, by the time it's gotten there, it's been brewing for a few decades already. And so that means that even the younger listeners in our audience and the younger people out there in general, given that this is the leading cause of death in the U.S. and worldwide, it's actually something that if we want to really effectively reduce the prevalence of this, the incidence of heart disease and people dying prematurely of heart disease or developing debilitating heart failure later in life, things like that, which is my day-to-day work is seeing people with these conditions, the best way is not to wait until you're 50 or 60 to start thinking about and treating these things, but rather to get on top of them when you're in your teens and 20s, starting out with all of the healthy lifestyle habits and getting your blood pressure checked and making sure all that stuff's under control early so that you can not lose a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades worth of exposure to these risk factors. You can get control of them much earlier in life, and that's the best way that you can reduce your risk of developing these serious complications.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to squat double body weight at 60, you first got to make it to 60. You know, that's important. You imagine if the American Heart Association had like a PSA or whatever, they sent out mailers. Like, oh, you turn 60, you get a AHA card in the mail from the American Heart Association saying, hey, thought about your heart health?
Just like, have you had your blood pressure screened? I suspect if that was done in reality, it probably wouldn't have any significant impact.
That's probably true.
But, you know, it's something that people ought to be getting done.
If we just took all of the, like, you know, chutzpah and effort putting into like marketing with social media and everything else and just applied it to, you know, public health. Oh man, I feel maybe we could do some good. We're going to, you know, we maybe should really ask. Yeah, maybe, or maybe not. Yeah, maybe not. All right. So let's talk about risk calculators. So what these do, they take the risk factors that we know tend to increase the risk of heart disease. And in general, we're talking about hard outcomes, increase the risk of having one of these, what we call a hard outcome. Hard is not like a cool like descriptor, but we're talking about things like actually having a heart attack, actually having a stroke, something like that. They take these risk factors and they incorporate them into a model. Now, you could get a sense of somebody's risk relative to another person or relative to themselves. If they didn't have as many risk factors, you could just say, oh, well, you know, having 3 risk factors is better than having 6 risk factors, or having 2 risk factors is better than having 4. Sure. But you still don't really have an accurate representation of what the real risk is, because not each risk factor affects the risk of having one of these hard events, these adverse cardiac events, proportionally. So you need to use large data sets to generate models of heart disease that can estimate this absolute risk for an event like a heart attack or stroke for a specific individual. What I mean by that is, like, you're going to have a greater risk of having, you know, a heart attack from smoking than you are from, you know, something like insufficient physical activity. That doesn't mean that I don't think people should be active, but it's just that smoking, you know, is much worse proportionally in this particular aspect than insufficient activity. Ideally, you'd have somebody who's very, very active and not smoking, but you know, when you incorporate this all together to try to predict or estimate risk, you need to do so based on current, you know, data. And so, Austin, you mentioned probabilistic thinking, you know, using probabilities here. And so these calculators spit out numbers, usually as percentages or whatever. When you're describing, you know, one of these outputs, you know, a 10% 10-year risk, for example, how does that frame not only your discussion with the patient, but how are you thinking about it personally?
Yeah, I think that I try not to generally use a lot of statistical conversation and numbers when I'm discussing these with patients, because it's very difficult. I mean, even physicians are really bad at probabilistic thinking when it comes to, you know, diagnosis and clinical reasoning and all sorts of stuff like that. So I think it's best tried to minimize that unless a patient is highly, you know, medically literate, has a great degree of understanding of these things, and is also just curious or interested, then sure, we can discuss those things. But I think that these, in, you know, I would intend them to be more like behind the scenes tools to aid the clinician, because the clinician is somebody who is tasked with trying to accurately assess this risk and try to modify it, you know, insofar as we can. But, you know, our brains are not even possible. It's not even possible for us to dynamically weight each of a given patient's risk factors and try to determine, you know, where we should, you know, attack the most or assess what somebody's risk is. I can't look at somebody's list of risk factors and do that kind of dynamic math in real time. And so these tools basically aid that for a general population sample. And insofar as, you know, the patient in front of me looks like the kind of person who was in the data sets that was used to build these models, then I can probably use that risk and give them at least a ballpark estimate. It's not going to be perfectly accurate for them because we don't have that level of, you know, technological biomedical advancement, like so-called precision medicine, which is a term that should raise like skepticism, I think, at this point in time. But the best we can do is to try to generalize from these large data sets to a patient that is relatively, you know, representative from that sample. So when I think about it, say one of these calculators spits out a number like, you know, a 15%, you know, 10-year risk, mentally, I think, okay, if I had 100 people like this person all going about their life for the next, you know, 10 years, then 15 of them are likely to experience a heart attack. Okay. And then if I treat them in whatever way with some degree of established risk reduction, say my degree of risk reduction is going to take them from a 15% risk to a 8% risk or something like that, like pretty good 50% relative risk reduction, more or less, then I would say, okay, well, if I do this to all 100 people, then instead of 15 people having a heart attack, then only 8 might have a heart attack. That's, you know, that might sound to listeners, they might be like, damn, that doesn't sound like it's that it works very well. I got bad news for you. That's how most things in medicine work. I mean, if you actually look at the effects, like even if you think about something like, you know, treating pneumonia with antibiotics or something like that, you know, in general, you're going to reduce the risk of somebody progressing or dying by some amount, but it's like actually a surprising number of people with that are probably going to get better on their own without treatment. And so that's the way most things are. I wouldn't say everything, but a lot of things, it's like, you know, to the extent that we can intervene, most things have modest to moderate effects. But again, now that when we're talking about the most common cause of death in the US worldwide, we're talking about like millions and millions of these events, then suddenly it's like, okay, well, if I can chop off, you know, 20, 30% of those from happening, that is not only an enormous reduction in the number of events, but also in subsequent disability, premature death, all sorts of things. And it becomes like a much more favorable proposition from that standpoint.
You know, I wonder how the framing of this goes into how people think about it, right? Because if they're like, oh, you're taking the risk from 15% down to 8%, and so that's not as good as I was hoping for. It's like, well, yeah, it'd be better if you were one of those 7 out of the 100 people, for example.
Sure.
But you know, and so they're like, eh, it's not so good. But then you're like, hey, look, I can take your performance, you know, up 0.25% if you take supplemental creatine. And they're like, hell yeah, brother. And it's like, wait, what? Like, anyway, all right, we'll have to have maybe a rant just an episode of rants in the future. But okay, so we're starting on the calculators here. We kind of led in with that. There are a number of different calculators, and most of them use the variables of age, sex, total cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, systolic blood pressure, diabetes, and current smoking status to estimate risk. Now, we won't cover all of the currently available calculators. There's just a ton of them. You got Framingham, SCORE, whatever, out the wazoo, really. But the most commonly used ones currently are this ACC and AHA calculator from 2013 and the ASCVD risk estimator plus. Now, Austin, you probably aren't doing too much of this in the hospital unless it's like a new onset, you know, sort of situation, or maybe you're just playing around with your own numbers just to be like, hey, like, am I good? Are you using the risk estimator plus, or are you using the old one from 2013?
Yeah. So in the hospital setting, I'm not, because pretty much by that point when I'm meeting somebody, it's clear what their level of risk is. And for the most part, like, they need to be treated if they're having a cardiac event, or if they have diabetes already, or whatever the case is. So the type of population that I see in the hospital setting is pretty different and generally not as appropriate. Once in a while, I'll get somebody for whom it might be appropriate, but still, this kind of decision is something that's best done in the outpatient setting by primary care docs instead of me, who I might not ever see you again if I discharge you from the hospital. But on the more outpatient side, primary care side, if I'm doing some telemedicine consultations or something like that, then I'm using the more updated one. When I went through training, you know, yeah, we were using that the pooled cohort equation from before. And then more recently, I had been using the 2018 one, even though, again, at this point, doing it so often with so many patients, I can often get a sense of, you know, where we're at and what their risk is. And the last caveat that I'll mention is that, and I've mentioned this on previous podcasts, we talk about it at our seminar, recognizing that a lot of these are 10-year risk scores. And so it depends on I take into account the person, their risk factors, their age, and their own preferences and values and things like that, right? And so if I have somebody who's, you know, I've had patients who are like in their early 40s or 30s or something like that, who wouldn't necessarily be strongly recommended for, you know, some form of intervention based on some of these older calculators. And I might recommend to them that I treat them anyway, because I make the case that, like, hey, here we are, you're 40. Yeah, I'm not necessarily expecting you'll have a heart attack by 50. And that's all this calculator is telling me, is that you're low risk for having a heart attack in the next 10 years. But I'm still concerned that you might have one by 60 or 70 or 80. And I don't want to wait until then to try to intervene. The only way that would make sense is if by waiting until then and then starting to treat you, I could still get you all the way back down to the same low risk that you are now. And that's not how this works, because again, it's cumulative over time, right? It's similar to, you know, if I was able to treat you and get your risk factor back down to when you were 30, that, like, your whole biology reverts back to the way it was when you were 30. It's like, well, we've lost a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades worth of exposure at that point. So I sometimes use this to support my decision, but even when it conflicts with my decision, sometimes I still make my own recommendation based on the context and the patient.
Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah. I want to cover just the two calculators we were talking about just briefly. And if you are a healthcare professional and you're looking for like a boards level review of these calculators, like this isn't it. Okay. I like intentionally simplified my explanations of these calculators so that we didn't get too far into the weeds. There are a number of caveats and, you know, exceptions and, you know, potential issues that one could raise if they're really into the weeds on these calculators. But for the general sense of where we're going describing this new PREVENT tool, I think it's important to know where we came from. So this, the 2013 pooled cohort ASCVD risk score from the American College of Cardiology and American Heart Association, this was developed via several large data sets from the United States, and it includes a different calculator for a different formula for both white and black individuals. Now, the outcomes are limited to both fatal and non-fatal stroke and heart attack. The potential limitations of this tool, there's no family history involved, so it may underestimate risk of those with a strong family history, especially for premature sort of heart disease. Diabetes is a yes or no question, not like how long have you had diabetes, what's been your cumulative exposure, what type of diabetes do you have, what's the status and efficacy of management. There's a difference between an individual with diabetes who's very well controlled and a person with diabetes who's very poorly controlled, for example. And also, this is based on older data sets. So this thing came out in 2013. And so all of the data that were into this pooled cohort equation was from before then. And so newer data with newer patients and newer sort of standard of care stuff. Yeah, that's changed what the equations would be. And there's further been updates to both lipid management guidelines and heart failure treatment that would, again, alter the sort of risk spit out from this calculator. So that was one that we kind of, when we went through training, that was like the one that we got exposed to the most. There's been an update in 2018. It's called the ASCVD Plus calculator. This incorporates not only the previous calculator's data that we just talked about, but also the million heart model. So some updated data, but again, not the most recent stuff because this was 2018. You know, that's 6 years ago and the data included in that is before then. So this includes updated risk predictions based on initiating therapy and response to therapy like aspirin, statins, treating high blood pressure, as well as smoking cessation. And it estimates a 10-year risk of heart disease for individuals aged 40 to 79. It does try to predict a 30-year risk and a lifetime risk for individuals aged 20 to 59. But when you go to the website to like plug and chug your data in there, it's like, yeah, so this actually, we don't actually have any data from like 20 to 30 to, you know, before 40 years old. We're just, assume you're 40, put in 40, let us do our calculations, which I guess is better than like not letting you come up with a risk score. But just, it's like a pop-up window that says, hey, just say that you're 40, like you can do it. And you're like, oh shoot, I could have done that on the other calculator. Right. Anyway. Yeah. And again, this calculator uses data primarily from non-Hispanic white individuals and Black Americans. A couple other limitations to this one. There's no social determinants of health incorporated in this at all. So no, you know, there's no stratification for individuals who live in like a low resource environment, for example. And again, diabetes is a yes or no question. Again, not really differentiating between how well diabetes has been managed, which would lead into some of the cumulative risk that we have been discussing this whole time. Okay, so now with that out of the way, let's introduce this new PREVENT tool. Now, again, we're not getting paid by the American Heart Association to tell you about their cool new tool. We just like, we're batting this around. We're like, hey, this is kind of cool. Let's talk about it, especially since, again, heart disease is so prevalent and, again, very, very important for long-term health. So this tool, which again stands for Predicting Risk of cardiovascular disease events, which has been dubbed the PREVENT calculator, is intended for primary prevention of heart disease. That just means those people without heart disease who haven't had a stroke yet, haven't had a heart attack, don't have heart failure. And it's for individuals between the ages of 30 to 79. And it uses age as the time scale. So again, some interesting modeling based on like this lifetime risk, lifetime exposure, which I thought was pretty interesting. It's based on over 6 million people in the United States from 46 observational cohort studies and electronic medical record data sets. And these are adults 30 to 79, which is pretty cool. You don't have to lie about your age anymore. You could just like plug it in there. It's pretty cool. And this estimated risk may assist and guide physicians and patients in a sort of shared decision-making sort of plan for interventions targeting lifestyle behaviors and the consideration of medications. A couple cool things. It combines kidney and metabolic health measures with heart disease risk factors to get a more complete picture of heart disease risk. So, for example, there's an elevated risk of heart disease in people with chronic kidney disease. That's well established, and it's actually been the focus of a number of different scientific statements from various national and international health organizations. In fact, individuals with chronic kidney disease are more likely to die of heart disease than progression of kidney failure. Hence the inclusion of, they do an estimated glomerular filtration rate. That's basically a measurement of how well your kidneys are working, and also an optional albumin creatinine ratio to assess kidney function. So effectively, you're getting a more holistic picture of how the patient's health is doing. It also adds BMI. It actually blew my mind. I knew the calculators before, but I guess I never registered to me that like none of them included BMI. And you're like, wait, why though? And this just, it helps to improve prediction quality amongst those, especially those who have an elevated BMI. So they actually had a pretty good discussion of that in the scientific statement, which I've linked in the description below, about how well the tool performed in individuals with a quote normal BMI. But since the majority of adults in the United States do not have a normal BMI, you would definitely want to include something that makes the estimation a little more accurate. So they included BMI. And instead of asking just diabetes, yes or no, it also gives it the option to plug in a hemoglobin A1C, basically a measurement of how well blood sugar has been controlled over the last few months. So you could use a yes or no answer to diabetes if you did not have that data. But if you had an A1C, you can plug that in and sort of fine tune an individual's risk factor. It still includes blood pressure, still includes lipid levels, still includes the question about tobacco use, but it adds a social determinant of health proxy. They actually need to plug in your zip code. Now, the researchers said that they wanted a variable that included like health risks related to racism, so like residential segregation, perceived racial discrimination, and additional social determinants of health, so like income, education, the amount of green space, places to be active in the neighborhood. But there wasn't a lot of standardized data available on each one of these things, so they just looped it together as a zip code, and apparently they found that that actually helped predict heart disease risk a little bit more accurately. It removes race from the sort of questionnaire. So on all of the other calculators, they're like, oh, are you Black, white, or non-white, Hispanic, something like that. They remove that. And they make a special point to say that they're not denying that there are any racial differences per se, but that race isn't the sort of biological underpinning that's affecting these different outcomes. Rather, it's more of a proxy in this case for maybe a social determinant of health or inequity in healthcare. So given the complex interplay of these risk factors, they bill this PREVENT tool as a comprehensive focus on heart disease prevention. The researchers wanted to integrate prevention and management strategies for not only heart disease, but also obesity, diabetes, and chronic kidney disease, because it's kind of all lumped together. And in fact, they call this in the consensus statement, cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome, CKM. Have you seen that in any of your notes lately? Patient has CKM?
I haven't seen it in any notes. I don't use this acronym in my documentation either. However, I mean, if I had to say what is probably the most common thing that I see cumulatively in all of the patients that I deal with in the hospitalized setting, it is apparently CKM.
CKM. Yeah, yeah.
It is,
yeah,
this. Yes.
And they go through different stages, which I won't read to you here because we get really into the weeds. But a cool note that they made about this is that the staging is bidirectional, meaning that you can have a person with like stage 4 cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome. So they have clinical cardiovascular disease and risk factors for kidney disease, obesity, et cetera. And if they improve all of those other risk factors, they actually slide back down to a lower stage. As far as the like utility of the staging process, like will there be different treatment algorithms based on different staging? That remains yet to be determined. But I thought it was pretty cool that they kind of like at least thought about this in advance, and it'd be useful for future data. Future studies to kind of sort of assess. As mentioned, they expanded the age range. So it's, now it's 30 on the low end instead of 40. And yeah, that ASCVD plus, they were like, oh yeah, you can use it as young as 20. And they're like, just lie by your age. I don't know. It doesn't really make much sense. But probably one of the most important factors here, in addition to adding like obesity, chronic kidney disease, diabetes, was that they added heart failure to the risk calculation. Previously, it was just a risk of like ASCVD, right? So just, you know, one subtype of heart disease, and effectively no calculator commented on heart failure. But there's been an increase in mortality rates amongst heart disease subtypes that have been relatively greater for heart failure compared with ASCVD. And heart failure is also the leading cause of hospitalization in people greater than 65 years of age, and it's increasing in all age groups. Approximately 6.7 million U.S. adults have heart failure, with estimates suggesting that prevalence may increase to 8.5 million by 2030. There's another recent sort of guideline from the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology that basically came out with different recommendations for the management an assessment of heart failure that came out in 2022. So the PREVENT calculator kind of wrapped that all together and said, hey, look, we could actually, you know, risk stratify or estimate people who might go on to develop heart failure, which would be another useful tool clinically.
I'll mention here, you know, most people are probably relatively familiar with concepts of like a heart attack when they think about things like a blockage and chest pain and leading to, you know, symptoms of part of your heart muscle effectively dying from lack of blood flow, pretty dramatic sort of thing, right? And stroke, maybe a little bit less so, but also a lot of people have concepts of stroke, maybe slurred speech, maybe a weak arm, maybe some kind of, you know, neurological symptom like that due to not enough blood flow to the brain. Heart failure, I find very few people among the general public have much of an understanding of or familiarity with. And additionally, the term is super scary to people because I've been many, 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 many times over the years, you know, in a position to deliver a new diagnosis of heart failure to somebody. And just that word failure, it sounds so dramatic. It sounds catastrophic. And so if you're listening, you think, gosh, how is this such a prevalent problem with people's hearts just failing left and right? Do they all end up needing to get, you know, heart transplants, or do they just die on the spot or something? But it's, I don't love the term heart failure, but it's pretty much embedded, and I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon at this point. Really, it just describes, you know, if I could oversimplify it in lay terms, it's any real significant impairment in the function of your pump. It might be pumping, you know, 10% less than it than a healthy level of pumping by your heart. Again, if I could oversimplify it, or rather than not pumping as well, it might have impairments in how well the heart muscle relaxes in between beats. There's a bunch of different types of it, but really it's just the pump isn't working quite as well as it should. But this can extend all the way to the pump is not working almost at all, and that's where somebody's in a very high risk situation of death, or they might need a heart transplant or something like that. But I don't want it, you know, I just want to introduce this idea of heart failure is very common. It's increasing in how common it is, because even just, you know, metabolic syndrome or just obesity itself is related with certain types of heart failure. And again, that's not to say that somebody develops obesity and then subsequently their heart just like stops working, but rather that the pump, just gradually, progressively works a little bit less efficiently, whether in terms of squeezing or relaxing or some combination of those things. And that can lead to a lot of downstream complications. It can lead to recurrent hospitalizations. Again, one of the very common things that I deal with day to day. So because that might be a new concept for some folks, I wanted to clarify, because it does sound admittedly quite scary to tell somebody that they have heart failure.
Yeah. What would you rebrand it as?
I mean, yeah, that would need some workshopping, I think. I think that like a, you know,
hypopompinosis.
And the excessively technical term, you know, that has historically been used here and there is like, you know, cardiac insufficiency or something like that. It's just not working quite as well, but still that's too complicated and nerdy of a term, I think. So,
yeah. All right, we'll figure it out. Look, if you got a great idea, we'll communicate it with the American Heart Association. We'll see if they take us up on this.
Yeah.
Some interesting mentions in the scientific statement. I did. I read the whole thing.
Respect.
Look, man, somebody's got to do it. there were a number of other risk markers that did not have a sufficient evidence base to support the inclusion into this model. So these include things like biomarkers of cardiac injury, so like a high sensitivity troponin, or like natriuretic peptides, so like B-type natriuretic peptide. And these are things that people, I wouldn't say they're not routinely assessed, but some people, particularly if they're getting like an executive physical, or if they're like, you know, maybe into the biohacking world or whatever, they're like, yeah, well, like my high sensitivity troponin is this. So like, what do I do about that? And it's like, not useful maybe for predicting the stuff, but you have some information that you can't really ignore if it's abnormal, right? Because then what do? You know?
Yeah, I see these tests and use them all the time. But again, I'm dealing with a different population most of the time who are coming in with concerns. I think that, you know, there is some, I'm aware of some guidance relating to some of these tests in more of an outpatient realm, but I definitely do not see that as being something that is like being strongly taken up at this point. So need more information before those become much more widely used predictive standpoint.
Yeah, yeah. Same thing with like diagnostic imaging. So certain CT results or echocardiogram type tests, and that's not surprising because those are kind of ordered. We usually ordered as like on an as needed basis, and there's not like millions of
yeah
exactly. A couple more interesting things relative to what we do here at the Barbell Medicine Podcast. The authors made a strong sort of point that they really wanted to include some metric of fitness, particularly cardiorespiratory fitness, but they didn't have enough data that correlated strongly to predicting one of these major adverse cardiac events, like a heart attack, stroke, heart failure, that they could draw from. And a lot of that has to do with how cardiorespiratory fitness is like coded in the research. Like sometimes it's METs, sometimes it's VO2 max, sometimes, and then further, even when it's coded, like does it actually, they actually measure or follow up on, you know, heart disease, like outcomes 10, 20 years down the road. And it's like, well, that would be a cool study to do. So if you're asking, hey, what study would you really like to do? Like, well, I would like to test. Here's what I want to do. I want to do a measurement of somebody's VO2 max, because I feel like that's better than METs. I understand why METs exist, but I don't care about them for this particular purpose. I want a VO2 max. Two, I want a hand grip dynamometer test. Three, I want a leg press 1RM. And four, I want a chest press 1RM. And I want millions of data points. And then I want you to follow them for 20 years, 30 years, or, you know, whatever, until you either run out of money or they die. And I want to see what sort of predictions we can make from those things and see if they would actually enhance this model, or if this model as it is right now is just as good at predicting sort of cardiovascular disease risk without the inclusion of these factors. What do you think about that?
I think that I would probably end up suggesting some modifications to your proposed study design. I think off the top of my head, there's probably some degree of redundancy in your different strength metrics there that might be from a practical standpoint, could be something you could simplify. And it'd be nice, rather than a prospective kind of observational cohort design, to have some interventional component to it, to really look at, you know, not just, because I can already tell you, you know, you can already tell yourself, you already know the answer of like how those kind of measurements are going to correlate with disease risk. But what we care about more is, you know, what we've talked about before, for example, this data on hand grip strength being, you know, favorably related to outcomes. Is that because of the strength, or is it because of that reflecting them being generally healthier? I think our bias for the, you know, is mostly the latter and a little bit of the former. But if you could have a clear intervention, you know, that specifically, you know, drives up that particular strength component and see what that does to outcomes. Again, it's not going to be still purely the strength, because there's a lot of effects of exercise, but you might have a little bit stronger case on that front. But I agree, it'd be nice to have some fitness thing. I think another limitation here is that cardiorespiratory fitness, even if it might be looked at in research, is not routinely assessed for in practice. So like,
yeah,
regular, you know, primary care and cardiologists are not doing some kind of systematic or validated measure of somebody's cardiorespiratory fitness in the outpatient setting that they can then use to plug into this calculator. So that component, they would have to introduce some way to measure that, might give you a question. And I suspect that question would end up being like, can you do this type of activity? And that activity might correlate to a given number of METs, because we do that already in like perioperative assessment of like,
yeah, how many flights of stairs
and things like that. Yeah, right. Yeah. And that's like, that's the closest you can get, even though it's like pretty accessible question, even if it's a pretty messy answer that you get out of it.
Yeah. I do wonder, I'm like, well, leg press 1RM, what if there's a difference? You know,
maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Similarly, there was not enough data on lipoprotein little a and apolipoprotein B tests to enhance this model further. But in the future, maybe there's a prevent to, you know,
I think there will be in the future, if I had to guess. Yeah.
Okay. So the big question is, does this model do a better job or how is it different in doing its job than the previous model, the ASCVD Plus or the 2013 pooled cohort equations? Well, the predicted estimates from the ASCVD Plus were a little bit higher than the PREVENT calculators. Effectively, PREVENT has used more recent data sets compared to the older calculators. And in this new data, they have a number of like different things that have happened to the patients being studied. So one, the new model accounts for the competing risk of non-cardiovascular death. So people dying from like other stuff. And they also include like new treatment guidelines. People are getting treated more often with statins, for example, which has a meaningful effect on risk estimates. So yeah, you have to kind of update the data sets that you're using as practice changes. So when I plugged my numbers in here, there was effectively no difference in like ASCVD risk. It was, you know, 1% or less than 1% in both equations. So that's not a flex, by the way. I'm just not old enough for it to have, you know, have a big risk. And I don't have any medical conditions right now that would really increase risk. But it did give me a heart failure risk, which I didn't have before. It's also low, thankfully. And it has a overall risk of any CVD, which is also still fortunately low. Did you plug your numbers into this by chance?
I think I did, but I don't remember off the top of my head. I think I would suspect them to be quite similar to yours. But I mean, to your point, like the data that these things are based off of really matters. If you look back and say you were to design some kind of a risk calculator based off of cardiovascular death statistics from like the 1960s. And it's like, well, that's when cardiovascular death rates were so high. Smoking was so prevalent. There was nobody was really doing much of anything about blood lipid levels. Hypertension treatment was like just in its infancy. And so rates were so high that any calculator based off that data would be really, really, really high risks for people. Nowadays, again, since then, contrary to what, you know, carnivore advocates say out there, rates of cardiovascular disease incidence, even though it remains the most common cause of death, have declined precipitously since earlier in the, you know, the last century for a variety of reasons relating to reductions in smoking, relating to better control of certain risk factors. I think that's going to continue now because not only do we have blood pressure and blood lipid lowering medications, as well as new ones that are helping with that, but also in the era of like GLP-1 related, you know, therapies for obesity and various other interventions that are quite potent on top of, you know, what we already know to work from a lifestyle standpoint. So I do think that, you know, the general rates of this are going to continue to, you know, be dynamic over time. And I'm glad that they're on top of updating the data to be, you know, contemporary.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll be curious to see like how this affects practice management. Like, are we going to identify heart failure risk, you know, much, much earlier than we otherwise would? Is the new model in maybe higher risk patients, is there a big difference in like, you know, who would get treated versus who would not get treated? I do think maybe the most interesting change that seems to be happening in practice is sort of the inclusion of this lifetime cumulative exposure sort of idea in general. And so, you know, right now, if you go look at the guidelines and you wanted like a really easy takeaway on like, all right, well, who should be treated? You know, like who should be on a statin or who should be on other medications? And it all has to do with like what your, you know, previously 10-year risk and now, you know, maybe 30-year risk if a lot of people jump on board with this new model. And it's like, well, look, if you had low risk, what they say is less than 5%, lifestyle, just do lifestyle. If you had what's called a borderline risk, so somewhere between 5% to 7.4% of a 10-year risk of having an adverse cardiac event, like, well, maybe you should treat, depends on your values and what you want to do and what specific risk factors we're talking about here. And then if you had a higher risk, 7.5% up to 19.9%, you should probably treat with a moderate intensity statin, potentially other risk factor modifying interventions like blood pressure, things of that nature. And then high risk, if you're greater than 20%, boom, straight to a high intensity statin. That's like the breakdown, right? But that doesn't really take into consideration this cumulative lifetime exposure sort of model that, again, I think is becoming a little bit more pervasive. And so now if you had somebody who, even if they were maybe low risk, or perhaps a better example would be borderline risk, you know, and they're like, I'm on the fence, like, should I treat my elevated LDL and triglyceride levels? And you're just like, well, like, you know, if you're one of your core values is to have a very long health span, and lower your risk over the lifetime, it's a pretty clear choice that you would probably want to lower your atherogenic load, the LDL, your triglycerides, and other sort of components of the cholesterol fraction that contribute to atherosclerosis. Similarly, if an individual had excess adiposity and they were like, well, I don't have any like really like, quote, obesity-related diseases right now. And you're like, yeah, but you would be at risk of them in the future if this persisted and we tried lifestyle and you really did, you tried your best. It just didn't work well enough for me to feel comfortable saying, you know, you get a gold star. Maybe that person would engage in, you know, using some of the anti-obesity medications to like treat that again, to produce future risk that maybe wasn't previously captured. I don't know. What do you think about all that?
Yeah. You mentioned that you think practice might be shifting in this direction. I think that to some extent we are in a bit of a bubble, particularly among those that we interact with and, you know, that we engage in tweeting with and things like that. I would say that probably, you know, still probably at this point, the majority of clinicians who are engaging in this sort of assessment and risk modification for patients are probably still operating on a traditional 10-year risk estimation, follow the algorithm for like this percentage risk, do this treatment. If this percentage risk, do that treatment, without really as much of a thought towards lifetime risk. You know, we get questions all the time on the forum. We get inquiries for consultations from young people who maybe have a family history, or they might be concerned about their heart disease risk. And they talk to their clinician and their clinician is like, nah, you don't need to worry about this right now. We'll check it down the line. Or, you know, you're too young to, you know, worry about this. Or worst of all, like you're too young to worry about treating this. And like, that is precisely the opposite mindset of what I would be thinking in this situation, knowing that this is my opportunity to prevent this from ever being an issue rather than waiting until it's already an issue. And then, you know, doing a half-assed way of trying to manage my risk at that point. So obviously I hope that this kind of approach to care becomes more generalized as it gets incorporated in guidelines. It will. It's just that is slow. That like even the uptake and adoption of clinical practice guidelines in practice is not rapid, and so that's going to take, I don't know, another decade probably before it's prevalent enough.
Yeah, we'll have a new tool out by then. Yeah. So the take home I'd leave you, you know, because if you're listening to this and you're like, all right, well, so now what do I do? Sweet new tool. Like what do? It's like, well, one, I think, you know, you and I stray away from like recommending, hey, make sure you go to your yearly doctor's appointment to, you know, get your labs or like whatever. And I was just having a conversation with a friend about this as well. He's like, well, do you recommend seeing a doctor like yearly, you know, even if they don't have anything like wrong with me? I'm like, I think it'd be hard to recommend that confidently. Although you could make the argument that like regular interfacing with your primary care physician would be useful to like make sure that you're not missing anything. And then further, if you actually had some risk factors that you were otherwise like kind of either unaware of or not really like, you know, keeping track of, well, that's what they're there for realistically. So I don't know that I can recommend confidently that you see your doctor yearly if you don't have like an active medical problem or something that's being monitored. But certainly if you're into your fourth decades or your 30s and you haven't seen a primary care doctor in a while, like would recommend doing that. And that would be a good time to get some basic sort of laboratory measurements, in this case, like a lipid panel at a minimum. And you could make the argument for an individual with who doesn't have a normal BMI, like an A1C, for example. There's just like a handful of tests that pretty much any doctor is going to be like, yeah, I would order that, and actually like make sense. If they say, hey, do you want a vitamin D level too? Like you can just decline, like not, don't need that. But there's like a handful of tests that I think you and I would be in agreement with. Like if you have never had this tested as a young adult or as an adult, you should do. And if it's been years and years and years, probably a good idea to check as well.
Yeah, I think that the traditional thinking of like a quote unquote annual physical, in particular the physical exam component, is not particularly useful for most folks outside of getting a blood pressure measured. So I think the blood pressure measurement should be done, I would say, annually. I'm good with that guideline. If not more often, I'm fine with that too. The blood lipid measurement, I'm good with that happening. The frequency of how often you should get your blood lipids measured, that's a more complicated conversation. Similarly, you know, discussions around whether you should measure a lipoprotein little a, like a one-time check in your lifetime, that's in some guidelines, but not in others. And so that's also a complicated conversation. We've done a podcast on that topic. And so, yeah, if it's like, I need to go to my doctor so they can listen to my lungs every year and I feel fine, I'm like, nah, no, you don't. You actually don't need that. That's not useful. But blood pressure is like super, super, super important. And then I think blood lipids would come next, as well as if you have, you know, be it strong family history or elevated waist measurement or signs or symptoms, obviously, then that changes the whole calculus here in terms of diabetes screening and things like that for some of these more common risk factors that we would worry about.
Yeah. So you get this data, right? So you got a blood pressure, you got, you know, some lipid numbers or whatever. Maybe even you got your doctor's like, look, I'll send the lipid panel, but I'm also going to send a chemistry just fine. To get you, you know, okay, sure. You got some blood, do your thing. So then you'll have your GFR estimated from that as well. So you can plug that all into a calculator. Now here's where I don't want people to do. I don't want people to like do this on their own and just go to the website and like plug in numbers and then get a number and then be like, what now? It's like, yeah, do this with your doctor.
And then I'm like, order some meds from like India or something.
That's
like
what I'm saying. The whole point of having a healthcare professional that you have established a relationship with and have rapport with is so that you can use them as an advisor on complicated matters that they have specialized training in. And, you know, you do other cool stuff that they don't have specialized training. I mean, this is the whole point, right? So, yeah, the idea would be to do this collaboratively with your physician and identify like, where's your risk and where are those risks coming from? Like if you have elevated risk factors that would increase your lifetime cumulative exposure to something that could increase your risk of heart disease, and it's within your means and to treat that or manage that, whether it's just with lifestyle stuff or whether it's with lifestyle plus some medication stuff, that's all fine. But I think this should be a collaborative effort. As far as treatment, the new scientific statement on this, they go through extensive efforts. They really bent over backwards multiple times in here. They emphasize lifestyle. Multiple times they emphasize lifestyle. And I thought that was actually a pretty nice touch. Like if you were a clinician or researcher or other sort of like scientific communicator and you went through and you read this whole thing, it would be impressed upon you how much lifestyle stuff the American Heart Association is really trying to push. And so they are labeling this their essential eight framework. They talk about the eight components here: diet, physical activity, adequate sleep, quality and quantity, tobacco avoidance, and you know, so on. And then receive guideline directed medical therapy for prevalent risk factors, whether that's diabetes, kidney function, obesity, etc. I think, you know, where it becomes a question of like, is this worth it or not, is a more personalized decision, right? And that's the whole point. Like if you're at relatively low risk right now, even your clinician may be like, I don't know that this is worth like doing anything about. Yeah, right now, because they're most familiar with the 10-year risk. And you're like, look, man, it's pretty low. Like, I don't know if this is beneficial. And you don't know either. Our view kind of would be like, well, if it's relatively low risk to engage in some sort of active management of this, right? The medication or the intervention or whatever doesn't really have a lot of side
effects. Yeah.
It's relatively safe and well proven. I would lean more towards like taking care of this stuff now to reduce the cumulative exposure. That'd be my personal preference, but that's reflecting my values. And that might not be the same for everyone else.
I think it's reflecting both your values and your recognition of that stat that I cited twice at the beginning of the podcast of that new onset cardiovascular disease happens in half of men before 65 and a third of women before 65. I think the kinds of people who you are alluding to who might like be more inclined to brush this stuff off at an earlier age and say, it's not worth it right now. I bet if you gave them that statistic, that is not something that they would know and they would be surprised by.
Yeah, I think you're right. So definitely want to push lifestyle, definitely want to get some numbers, especially if you haven't seen your doctor recently. I think that'd be a reasonable choice. And then assess your risk and go from there based on your values and the shared decision-making plan that you work with collaboratively with your health professional. Austin, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that this is nice to see. It brings it in line with kind of what our position has been in the past couple of years based on the available evidence. And so as far as how much this is going to impact what I do day to day, it kind of remains to be seen since I had been to some extent, doing some of this already in using my own judgment and ignoring 10-year risk for younger people and making recommendations anyway. But it'll be interesting to see. And I am confident that they will continue updating these risk scores and keep the data up to date with current times, which is what's going to be most important as we move forward.
Yep. Hey, we're biohacking heart health here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. All right. Thank you so much for listening. This has been episode 278. Special thanks to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining me here on the podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.